So from observations to numerical simulations, so what I will be talking about today is this galaxy formation in Lambda CDM simulations. So here in this first slide, you see the final product, the redshift zero, of a very high resolution simulation of a pure dark matter cluster. That you could do the same thing for a galaxy, would look exactly the same, redshift zero. So this is showing basically the state of the art of what we can do now for pure dark matter simulations. We are able to resolve a halo like this with as many as 30 million particles inside the virial radius, to the point that we can resolve sub-halos of sub-halos. This is a simulation that was recently completed in Zurich. But the situation is not so good when you run simulations where you couple baryons and dark matter. And so far, we still don't know if we can really form a galaxy like this with a nice smooth disk in a simulation using a Lambda CDM structure formation scenario. So the problem, which is quite well known, is the so-called angular momentum catastrophe. And here you see just a version that was shown in Navarro and Stamets' paper, sort of classic two plots that many people have shown. So the first one shows the angular momentum as a function of the rotational velocity. These data points are from Courtois et al. They are late-type spirals. And all these other points are simulation results at redshift zero. In particular, these open dots are for Lambda CDM simulations. And I don't need to point too much to the plot to tell you that there is an order of magnitude deficiency in the amount of angular momentum at a given rotational velocity. Same thing if you try to reproduce the Talley-Fisher relation, which of course is related to how you are evolving the angular momentum in the system, rotation velocity versus luminosity, in this case is the I-band. Again, this is the real galaxies, these are the simulations. For a given luminosity, you have a rotation velocity which is too high, and that's because you are forming a baryonic core that is too concentrated because you lost angular momentum. So the explanation that people have done, have tried to put out for this angular momentum problem, relies on the fact that in the simulations, what typically happens is that you form a lot of very dense, cold baryonic cores in the progenitors of the galaxy. And by redshift zero, these things will fall to the center because they suffer a lot of dynamical friction. And by suffering dynamical friction, they lose angular momentum. And so you end up with this dense baryonic structure at redshift zero. Now, one way you could overcome this problem, which is the classic solution that people have proposed so far, is heating the gas somehow so that you don't allow it to collapse in the progenitor lumps. You keep it more diffuse so the gas won't lose so much angular momentum once it sits inside the main halo. Of course, feedback by supernovae or also by other sources like AGNs, for example, is a necessary requisite in a model of galaxy formation. But I want to point out that there is an important second aspect that we need to understand, and that's how our results depend on the numerical resolution of the simulations. And it's quite important to realize that most of the simulations that have been run until 2 or 3 years ago, like the ones that produced the plots that I showed you before, were using only a few thousand dark matter and SPH particles in their simulated galaxies. And their force resolution was actually worse than 1 kiloparsec, whereas you know that the typical scale length of a disk is of order of 1 kiloparsec. So you can really cast doubts about how the simulations were actually able to do what they were set up to do. So there are several numerical effects that can enter a simulation and alter the evolution of the angular momentum and of the energy of your particles. Here I have a list of them. I won't go through them in detail because it's quite lengthy and also can be pretty boring for people who are not numerical experts and don't like to go into details about this. Let's just mention the first one, which is quite well known, artificial two-body heating. Typically what you have in a simulation where you have baryons and dark matter is that you have halos with a lot of dark matter particles, and inside these halos you have these baryons, stars, or gas particles. And because you are living in a cold dark matter universe, typically the mass of the particles of the dark matter is much higher than the mass of the particles of the gas or the stars. And so these dark matter particles can act really like bullets eating the baryons and the particle in the baryon component and transferring angular momentum and also energy. What typically happens is that you start with a cold sheet of baryons and you end up with a hot spheroid simply because you're artificially changing the energy state of the system. Now we'll show you a movie which makes this quite clear. So here you start with a very cold sheet of particles embedded in this coarse resolution halo, and you see that the cold sheet is becoming thicker and thicker as time goes by. If you calculate the effective the relaxation time of the system, the theoretical relaxation time, it is of order of 100 times longer than the Hubble time. But already at this stage, 7 gigahertz, you are already at 0.1 almost of the fraction of the relaxation time. So you're basically changing the dynamical state of your system. And you're transferring energy so that the system becomes extremely hot compared to the initial state. So one way to try and overcome this problem due to the low resolution of the simulations is to use the so-called renormalization technique or multi-mass refinement technique. This was pioneered by John Dubisky in 1994 and has been used by several other people recently. But usually in pure dark matter simulations, there are only a few examples that did this using a simulation with both dark matter and baryons. That's what we actually did. You see here the technique is the following. You start with a very big box, in this case it's a 100 megaparsec box. Then you select a region that you want to follow in more detail, and you refine the resolution in this region by adding more particles and also adding a small scale power in the power spectrum. Then you do it in several steps in order to avoid contamination from the low resolution region. Otherwise you will get these big particles falling in and changing the energy state of the system, as I showed you before. And if you do it carefully, you can get a resolution such that you can resolve a galaxy-sized halo with several hundred thousands or a million particles within a large box as this. So you keep also all the tidal field of the larger scale. So the code that was used to do these simulations is Gasoline. This is a list of people who have been involved in the work that I will be showing to you. And the code is massively parallel, is SPH and body code. It's very similar to Gadget in many respects. For the particular simulation that we'll show you now, the physics included are listed here. So there's basically atomic cooling, star formation with one of the classical recipes by Katz in 1992. Supernova feedback is included only in a very, say, weak mode. There is only thermal energy transferred to the gas as a result of supernova explosions. We know that this is a very mild feedback, almost no effect in reality because the energy will be quickly radiated away. And also there's heating by uniform cosmic UV background that sets in at redshift 6.
Do experiments have one feedback?
Thermal feedback only, yeah. Sorry?
Is there a really long delay between the formation of the star particle and the...
Well, we take into account this delay, yeah, with the supernovae 1 and supernovae 2. But the thing is that, you know, it's known that thermal feedback only won't have a strong effect because you radiate away the energy very quickly. So I would say that the main heating source, the main non-gravitational heating source in the simulation is actually due to the UV background. So what I will show you now is a movie on one such simulation that follows a region that by redshift 0 has this virial mass and virial radius. So it's like corresponding to a very large galaxy halo, probably larger than the Milky Way. And by redshift 0, you still have this high number of particles in the region, which is an order of magnitude higher than the simulations that were run until, say, the beginning of 2000. So you will see now the dark matter depicted in blue and the baryons depicted in red. And it starts at high redshift, about redshift of 20. It's quickly going through the formation of very small, dense cores that are collecting at the center of what will be the core of the forming galaxy. Now, very soon, this is redshift 2.5, there's a very massive merger with three big lumps of nearly equal size forming. And this is the last major merger. After this time on, is more infalling of smaller lumps and also smooth accretion of gas. You see now a disk, a clear disk has formed with also spiral lumps that are also triggered by the tidal perturbation of the different satellites that are falling in, also plunging through the disk. These satellites, of course, will affect the evolution of the disk itself. Like you see, by redshift 0, we have formed a disk. And now when you look at the disk in more detail, so you say you color code the star particles at redshift 0 according to their age, So if you look at star particles with age less than 10 years, this is how they are distributed in a disk which is also rotating. I will show you the kinematics in a moment. And stars older than 10 years, this is basically, 10 years is basically the age of the last major merger with the three big lumps. They are mostly distributed in a stellar halo and a spheroidal, dense spheroidal component. And if you go to a more quantitative analysis of the simulations, for example, you can plot the stellar surface density profiles of the galaxy at redshift zero, and you can again differentiate between young and old stars in the same way as I did before. So the young stars are the field dots. This is the profile of the young stars. The open dots is the profile of the old stars. So you can see quite a number of things. First of all, that the old stars tend to dominate more in the center because this is actually the spheroid, the bulge component. But you also see that the old stars are fit by Devo-Couleur profile quite well. But when you look at the young stars, that you would guess they should be a nice exponential disk. They are actually not an exponential disk. Overall, their radial range, there's a steeper profile in the center and a shallower in the outer plane. You could easily fit it with two exponentials. Why is that? Why you don't get a single exponential? Well, it's quite easy to understand. If you look at the galaxy at redshift zero, again, this is color-coded with age, so the brighter colors are for younger particles. You see that the star particles in the center are the youngest, and they are distributed in a sort of oval or bar-like configuration. So the system actually went bar unstable. You can see that in a simulation, and that's why you form the central excess of density. This is something that is well known in simulations of bar formation and evolution. Whenever you have a bar, you tend to steepen the central density profile. And the scale length of the disk in the outer part, so say the disk which is outside the bar, it's about 3.2 kiloparsecs, so it's a reasonable scale length. When you look at the mass distribution in the galaxy, so you can plot the circular velocity profile, which is basically the rotation curve, assuming that you have a test particle moving the potential with only, you know, pure circular motion, that's what would you measure. It's like this red curve here. When you try to split the contribution to the potential that gives rise to this curve in stars and dark matter, the dark matter is the black line and the stars is the blue line. So you see the system is actually baryon-dominated out to several kiloparsecs because there is this quite concentrated bulge plus bar. And you see that if you compare that with the rotation curve of, say, M31, these blue dots, it is quite different. It's not only the offset. This you can change by just changing the mass of the halo, for example, selecting a different area in the simulation. But it's really the shape. This is much flatter than this red curve. So this is telling you that somehow the spheroid in the center is much more massive than the spheroid of Andromeda. That's actually the case because if you try to calculate the bulge-disk ratio based on the composition that I showed you before, you get a bulge-disk ratio of almost 0.4, which is about a factor of 2 larger than what you get in the M31 or the Milky Way. So this system is definitely too spheroid dominated to be representative of, say, an SB galaxy. But it has a disk which is reasonable. The other interesting thing is the actual kinematics of the galaxy. So forget about doing the circular velocity profile, but do the actual kinematics. So you measure effectively the amount of rotation and the amount of velocity dispersion that you have in the stellar component. So the green dots are the rotation of the stars, and these are instead represents the radial velocity dispersion of the stars. So you see that the system is also quite kinematically hot. The V over sigma is always around 2, and in the center is even lower than 2 because of the bar that has mostly radial motions. Such a system, again, is not comparable to what you see in Milky Way, for example, or M31, where the V over sigma is always around 4, even in the thick disk, even including the thick disk. So it is too kinematically hot. And you can ask, why is that? Well, certainly one reason is the fact that you have all the satellites falling in and perturbing the disk. So if you look at the disk, how it looks at redshift 0.6, this is how it looks, and this is how it looks inside the redshift 0. Clearly, there's a big difference in the center where you form the bar that was not present here, but there's also a big difference in the sense you scattered a lot of disk particles to higher energy orbits. And that's because, certainly part of it is because you have satellites like this one plunging through the disk and eating it. But the question is it just because of the satellites, or there's also some residual source of numerical heating? Remember the movie that I showed you at the beginning of the talk, where you can heat a sheet by numerical two-body relaxation. Before going to the numerics even more, let's just conclude about where the galaxies, where the galaxy in our simulation will end up if I put it on a plot like this one, where you have, again, a Tully Fisher relation. So here I'm putting not only our point, but also the point taken from the simulation of a body at all. In these simulations, they have 5 times less resolution than our simulations, but they have a stronger feedback. They have some sort of kinetic feedback. So you don't only give thermal energy, but you give also kinetic energy to the particles surrounding the region where the supernova explosion has occurred. And what you see is, first of all, in this plot, late-type spirals are the data points here, and these other data points, the blue with error bars, are for zero galaxies. So you see, this is where our galaxy ends up. It is not on the relation, but it's not very far from it. This is where their galaxy ends up. And here you see the same thing that you saw at the beginning with the new galaxies for angular momentum versus rotational velocity. And you see two versions of it. You see the total galaxy stars. This is where we are, and this is where they are. And you see just the stars in the disk. So removing the bulge and stellar halo, this is where we are, and this is where they are. So you see that there's no more any order of magnitude problem in terms of angular momentum deficiency. We are actually both pretty close to the relation, still not on the relation. So we have a system which is certainly still too dominated by low angular momentum material. That's why the total of the stars is still quite low. But when you just consider the disk, it's definitely quite close to the expectation.
So the improvement is through the supernova feedback,
would
you say?
Compared
to earlier system.
The point I want to make here is that really the crucial thing in my way in getting the disk quite close to this relation is not the feedback itself, but is really the resolution of the simulations. Because you see that they have less resolution, but they have a stronger feedback, and we end up basically in the same point. But actually the stars, the total stars, are closer to the relation in our case than in their case.
Sorry,
yes, 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
No, what I'm saying is different. What I'm saying is that you don't need feedback to cure the angular momentum problem. Feedback will certainly enter in the simulation for other reasons that I will try to show you now.
Artificial heating that they have.
Exactly. I mean, it's mostly the fact that the two-body heating and also other numerical effects that I will discuss in a moment. That, yeah, exactly. So, for example, if you... Just to convince you, suppose I repeat the same simulation that I've discussed now at two different resolutions. So this is the final state of the total stellar component at redshift zero for the simulation that I discussed now. And this is what I get if I reduce the resolution by almost a factor of 10. So you clearly see that the size of the system is almost by high 50% smaller, and you don't see the signature of the disk that you see here. You don't see it here. So just changing the resolution completely changes the size of the final system that you get. But of course, I mean, this leaves you with several questions. One of the questions is, we certainly gain by increasing n, but how can we measure the numerical reliability of the simulation? So shall we increase just as much as we can the resolution and hope that at some point we'll form a bulgeless galaxy? This, of course, is a bit, not the ideal way of doing that, because you want to have scientific control of what you're doing. Exactly. We need to find somehow a way to estimate the convergence of the simulations. For the moment, you just see there's a difference, but you know. So the thing is that in my view, you will never do it. You will never study the convergence of the simulations by just running cosmological idle simulations. And why is that? Because they are extremely complex. You have several mechanisms, including the simulations. There are several ways the numerical effects can enter several all these mechanisms. And plus, you have a system with a continuously changing potential because the galaxy is growing. So the only way to control the resolution effects is to combine the cosmological simulations with a simpler type of numerical experiments. And I will just show you two examples of this. I will start actually with number two. Number two is the following. Suppose that I want to estimate more quantitatively the numerical heating that I have once I collected most of the mass in the halo, and I have you start to see a disk like a redshift 0.6 in my simulations. And remember, a redshift 0.6, I was seeing a disk that by redshift 0 becomes thicker. So how can I estimate the amount of numerical heating that you still have in a simulation like the one that I ran? And one way of doing it is you make a model of the galaxy at redshift 0.6. So you make a model which is as close as possible to the galaxy that you have in the cosmological simulations. A multi-component model with a stellar disk, and also a gas disk inside the stellar disk, and a dark matter halo. And then you just evolve this model with different resolution in the number of dark matter particles, number of gas particles, number of star particles. There's no cosmological accretion now, so there's no satellites. All the heating that you will see is just numerical. And this is what you get. If you do different resolution experiments, say you start with an experiment where the halo is resolved by only 10,000 particles, and you measure the amount of angular momentum loss over a time scale of about 8 gigaheres, so it's even more than from redshift 0.6 to redshift 0. And what you see is that this is what, over 8 kiloparsecs. This is what you get. You get an overall your disk extent, you have lost more than 60% of the angular momentum just because of the transfer of kinetic and energy and angular momentum between the star particles and the dark particles, the massive dark particles in the halo. When you increase the resolution of the halo to 100,000 particles, and this is what you get, so our situation has improved a lot. I'm keeping the number of SPH particles fixed for the moment. It was 10,000 here and 10,000 here. Then you can increase also the number of SPH particles. You see there's an improvement even more, but clearly the big jump was by just changing the number of dark matter particles. So really the two-body relaxation effects due to the fact that you are resolving the dark matter component too coarsely are fundamental in this kind of tests. There's another way of trying to control the numerical effects, and that's investigating even more the role that numerics are having SPH itself, so in the baryons themselves. And that's by constructing another type of controlled experiments where you start with a dark matter halo, you put a gas inside the dark matter halo in hydrostatic equilibrium, it's an NFW model with a rotating embedded gaseous halo, then you let it cool and eventually even form stars, so you have sort of the same physics that you had in the cosmological simulations, but there's no cosmological accretion, so there's only an isolated galaxy. You could ask me, but how is that relevant to the formation of galaxies in lambda CDN? Well, one point that one has to realize is to form this galaxy, independently of resolution, you need to have the last major merger to occur very early on. This is a conclusion that everybody agrees on. Otherwise, you will form an elliptical. So in the simulation that I ran, the cosmological one, I was selecting a galaxy that had the last major merger of redshift 2.5. The same did Abadi et al. To get a reasonable disk. So by the time on, really, most of the mass that is accreted is a smooth accretion of gas from the outer part of the halo, as opposed to merging of lumps. So this is actually relevant for this late stage of galaxy formation, which is the stage at which you expect to form the disk. So again, so you follow the cooling of the gas inside this dark matter halo. There's no heating here, not even UV heating. We only play with different temperature floors. And again, you do resolution tests. Now, this time, the resolution tests are done in a way that two-body heating by dark matter particles shouldn't be an issue, because we always use 100,000 dark matter particles. So what should be, say, the reasonable limit according to the previous plots to avoid numerical two-body heating. So any other effects that will show up is related more to the SPH component itself, the gas particles. And you see here convergence tests for the mass of cold gas, so that literally is the growth of the disk over time. And here instead you see the growth of the angular momentum of the disk over time.
Sorry, what are the curves?
So I'm going to that. So The green curves in both plots are for a simulation where I use 100,000 dark matter particles, but only 20,000 SPH gas particles. Then there is, you know, a bunch of other curves. I just want you to focus on the two most extreme resolution cases. The black line, this one, is using 100,000 dark matter particles and also 100,000 SPH particles. So I just changed the number of SPH particles. And this one, the red one, is using 1,000,000 dark matter particles and 500,000 SPH particles. So you can clearly see that in both cases, both in the mass growth and in the angular momentum plot, the big difference is when I go from the red, so from the green line, lower resolution SPH, to the other lines, especially for the mass of the disk. When you increase from 100,000 SPH to 500,000, you still have an improvement, but it's certainly not as big as the previous one. So the big jump is between 10,000 and 100,000 SPH particles. And the reason why this is playing a role in both the angular momentum and in the mass of the disk is because basically if you have a resolution that's too coarse in the SPH, you will under-resolve the density, and that will affect actually the cooling of the gas. And what you end up doing is you lose preferentially the higher angular momentum gas, which is the one that has lower densities and is far out in the halo. So you see that based on this plot, you will conclude that you need at least 100,000 SPH particles to converge reasonably in mass of the disk and angular momentum of the disk. Mass resolution is not the only problem. Another problem is the force resolution. Suppose now I just stick to my best values of the resolution for SPH and dark matter particles, and then I change the force resolution. So in an SPH simulation with gravity, this is basically changing the gravitational softening. So this is the gravity force resolution that I'm changing here. And on the left, you see same mass resolution, so same number of particles at two different times for a simulation with a softening of 2 kiloparsecs. By comparison, this disk is about 15 kiloparsecs in radius. And on the right, you see a softening of 0.5, so 4 times smaller than this. So you see that initially you form a bar in this disk, but by the time of 5 years, you have a nice smooth disk in the lower softening, the higher softening case, and instead you still have a bar with spiral arms, much more structure when you use a lower softening, which is higher force resolution. Why is that? Simply because here the softening was right about the bar length scale, so it was not enough to resolve the bar mode in the disk. Now, you would say, okay, so we lost a bar, but what does this mean in terms of disk formation? It actually has quite an important implication, because you completely change the evolution of the surface density profile of the baryons. And you see here, again, different tests with changing resolution in the force and also in the number of particles. Just stick to the curves representing the two cases that I just shown you in the previous pictures, and these are indicated here. So the low softening case, sorry, high softening case, 2 kiloparsec is this dashed line. So you follow the high, this profile, the dashed line here. And the other one, the solid line with this steep central overturn, is the case with the smaller softening. So you can see two things. If you feed the profiles with an exponential, this is what you get for large softening, this is what you get for small softening, and then you need to fit the inner part with a much steeper exponential. So you have a bimodal profile, purely bimodal, with higher force resolution, where the bar has survived, and you have instead an almost single exponential profile with just a small excess in the center when the bar has gone. Of course, with higher force resolution, you would think that you were actually resolving the evolution of the system better. So this should be the correct answer, the one with the double exponential profile. The other interesting point is that the outer slope of the profile when you have this double exponential case is actually different, and you get a larger scale length when you measure the scale length here than in this case. So this is quite important, because if you don't resolve the bar, you will actually measure a different scale length in the system. You will change the evolution of the outer disk, not only the evolution of the central region of the system. And that's also quite well known by people who have worked a lot on dynamics of bars in galaxies. Was pointed out first of all by Ohl in 1971, and also in papers by Tumri. The bar can transfer angular momentum to the outer disk and can change effectively the profile of the outer disk. So suppose you go today and measure the scale length of disks and then compare with what you get in the simulations. This is another effect that could actually change the comparison between the simulations and the observations if you're not...
You predict what the gas looks like.
This is just the gas. This is the gas.
Oh, I thought you said it was the star.
No, this is the gas. Yeah.
How common are the bars?
Sorry?
Do you always get a bar?
It depends on how you actually set up your model. What's the baryon fraction? What's the spin parameter of your system? For example, now we'll show an example of a system without a bar that was built in order to hopefully not get a bar. And you can do that, you know, you can get inspiration for the models of Van den Bosch or Moetzel, and you know, you there are parameters that you can use to measure the susceptibility of a system to bar formation. And this depends mainly on how much, what was the spin parameter of the system. The bigger is the spin parameter, the larger will be the density you form, so the lower density will be the less prone to baryon stability. At the same time, you can change the baryon fraction. The lower baryon fraction you have in your system, the less dense will be, the less will be prone to baryon stability. So if you want to form a galaxy like M33, where you don't see a bar, it's just a disk with a nucleus in the center, of course you need a system that is bar stable. So that's what we try to do, is build a model which, according to this semi-analytical model, should be giving a galaxy without a bar. We use, in this case, a very high resolution. Since the galaxy has a low baryon fraction, these two-body relaxation can be even worse. So you need to use a shell model where you have more particles, more dark matter particles near the center of the system and less outside. The effective resolution in the center of the system, say within 20 kiloparsecs, is 10 million dark matter particles in this case, and the baryons are half a million inside the virial radius of the system. And now you'll see a movie which shows you the formation of the disk face on and edge on. And you see effectively that this system, you don't form a bar. You have a nucleus in the center, you have spiral arms. The other interesting thing is you see this sort of clumpy accretion at the boundary of the disk, which is something that we are investigating at the moment. It seems might be possibly related to what Mahler and Bullock have found in their paper, but it's a work in progress.
What is it that suppresses the bar?
It's simply the fact that we have a combination of low baryon fraction and high spin parameter. So the gas cools, and then, of course, it has more angular momentum compared to the previous system. So the disk will tend to be larger and lower density. Okay, so there's a critical threshold. You can measure the susceptibility of bar formation using the ratio between the amount of baryons versus the amount of dark matter within a given radius. And this system falls below this threshold. So then what we did is we measured the profile of the system at the end. So you don't have a bar here, so you expect something different. Maybe we get a nice single exponential disk. The fact is that we don't get it even here. And it's quite interesting because it relates to the problem that Frank Van den Bosch pointed out a few years ago, that says the following: forget about the angular momentum catastrophe and the complications of cosmological simulations. Just stick to the case where you have isolated galaxy, gas cooling inside an NFW halo. Would you get an exponential disk there? And he said, no, you wouldn't, because basically, since you have a cuspy NFW profile in the dark matter halo, if you start with an angular momentum distribution of the gas, which is proportional, basically the same specific angular momentum distribution of the dark matter as given by the simulations, you will tend to form a disk with a profile which looks like this. It's a power law. These are different models by Frank Van den Bosch. A power law instead, an exponential disk. So we said, let's see and measure the profile in this case. This is very similar to what Frank did, although the difference is this is a simulation. In his model, he had some assumptions. Well, we also started with the same distribution of gas and angular momentum in the system. And that's what we end up. This is the black line that you see here. So it's not a pure exponential, but it turns over to a much steeper profile in the center. And again, you fit it with two exponentials instead of one. The power law profiles of Frank, two different power laws, R to the minus 1 and R to the minus 1, are these two. They don't fit our system as well. So our system is different from both the exponential, this case, and Frank's.
Are we getting too much gas in the center?
We are getting too much gas.
Too much. So yeah. What do you do about that?
Right, exactly. And the reason why we think that we are getting an answer which is different, but even from Frank's result, is that in his semi-analytical models, it doesn't have self-gravity of the disk. Okay? Sorry. It doesn't have the self-gravity of the disk. So once the disk forms, right, it doesn't feel its own gravity, so it cannot develop any mode, not just the bars, but even spiral arms. Okay? What we see in our model, And the question now is how numerical or physical it is. It's a lot of modes, a lot of structure. You can see here these high order spiral arms. And you can see that at the point where we actually measure it, at the point where the spiral arms are stronger, the inflow of gas towards the center is also stronger. So it's removal of angular momentum due to the disk modes that piles up the gas in the central region. Now the interesting thing is the M33 also has a nucleus. So you might think, okay, well, maybe this is not so far from the truth because there is a nucleus in M33. You see this turnover at very small radius. But the point is that you see that the radius, which is almost an order of magnitude smaller than the radius at which we see it. So still, there's something different between the simulation and reality. So in the last few minutes, I know actually how much time I have to do it, but I will just run through a few more slides, four they should be, where I show you another project that is been going on with all these people at the University of Washington, and also James Wozniak at the McMaster University, and Red Friedman at NYU, where we're saying, okay, let's attack the problem from another point of view. Now we sort of have an idea of the resolution requirements at redshift zero for the galaxies. Let's see if we can get a better result in terms of, you know, mass of the spheroid and so far by implementing a more realistic way of doing the feedback in the systems and doing the heating by feedback. So in this case, we actually simulated three objects. One is the galaxy that I already discussed at the beginning of my talk, a giant spiral galaxy. The other one is smaller mass, more close to the Milky Way, and the other one is like a LMC, a Large Magellanic Cloud Size system. And you can ask me later about the model itself, but basically it sort of goes very close to ideas that you see in the CIT 2003 papers. So there's an efficiency of star formation, efficiency of supernovae winds. There's a way to follow the, in a very crude way actually, the turbulence of the IGM using an entrainment factor and using a time scale for the decay of turbulence. Very similar to what was done by Thacker and Kauchmann. Basically, you don't allow the gas to cool relatively for about 20, 30 megahertz. This sort of takes into account the fact that you will have energy in turbulent motions in the gas following the supernova explosions. Then you do tests using simple models, again, isolated galaxy models with no cosmological context to see how you get all these things right, star formation rates from SDSS, the Schmidt law, how thick the disks are, a ratio between cold and hot gas in the disk, the actual amount of turbulence, if it's realistic or not. And this is sort of shown here. You see the gas distribution of the small galaxy, 70 kilometers per second, how it evolves when you have this feedback going on. You see all these outflows and sort of like fountains. If you do the same thing for a larger galaxy, Milky Way size, of course you see that the gas remains more confined towards the center, but you can see all these effects of explosions that are going off at times. Then you can say, okay, so now let's put this model, feedback model, in the cosmological simulation. To the left you see the movie that you've seen already, and now you'll see the movie of the same simulation with this feedback model, and you will appreciate that the main difference is in the fact that you won't see as many luminous satellites as you see here. You see everything looks darker, and that's why you're suppressing the formation of luminous satellites.
Satellites are still there in darkness.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So you're suppressing the luminous components basically, and actually even the baryons themselves. So most of the satellites are empty. As you go to lower redshift, you can see some of the satellites that actually managed to form stars because they were massive enough to retain their gas. We get a much better luminosity function of satellites here than here, of course. Here was an order of magnitude.
So that blue stream, is that a filament that goes further out?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a bigger structure. But by redshift zero, that's what I want to point out, going back to what Andrea asked before. Although, you know, the situation as far as satellites and amount of baryons in the halo might have changed a lot, the disk size is more or less the same here and here. So for the disk, it didn't actually make a significant difference, but for other things it makes a big difference. So for example, here you see the star formation histories of the galaxy that I just showed you, this one, the smaller galaxy, Milky Way size, and the dwarf galaxy, all three in a cosmological context. You see that the dwarf galaxy forms stars over a much more extended time. There's no strong peak like here or here. And then you put it on the plot by Sloan showing the star formation rates versus mass, These are the 3 points. These are, sorry, 1, 2, 3. These are other other two simulations that we run with intermediate masses. And you see that they actually fall where they should fall. This is where the Milky Way is. So the star formation rates versus mass is well reproduced. And then you can get a hint, although this is still work in progress, so don't take it extremely seriously, but it certainly shows that there's an interesting hint of anti-hierarchical formation of the galaxies themselves in hierarchical structure formation. What I'm showing here is the McArthur and Courtauld plot, the stellar age versus rotational velocity of the galaxies. Again, the three galaxies, LMC size, Milky Way size, larger spiral galaxies. And what I'm showing you here is the peak of the star formation rate. So that, say, the age that most of the stars have, say 70% of the stars. And you see that, indeed, the smaller galaxy is younger than the larger galaxies. So there's a hint that by a combination of, feedback and high enough resolution, you can find the disk in the simulations with correct properties and also have the correct ages.
This is the disk age.
Yeah. This is the disk age. So these are the conclusions. I say, just summarizing, I would say that the main point is, I think you need at least 100,000 dark matter particles and 100,000 SPH particles to overcome most of the numerical effects. Now the point is when you need them. So what I've showed you here was requirements applied to the late formation of the disk. So once you have the last major merger, you form the disk, you need these requirements. But in principle, you would need these requirements always, even at the beginning of your simulation, or redshift 15 or 20. This is a big problem, because if you work out, you know, what's the resolution that you would need to do that, it's impossible. The problem is impossible to solve, because the more you increase the resolution in a CDM model, the more you will see smaller structures forming earlier on. So this is really difficult to solve in principle. And the only way, I think, to actually do convergence tests in a cosmological simulation is to set up a limit to the power spectrum, like a warm dark matter model. Don't take it as a physical model, it's just a numerical tool that I'm thinking of. So you have a fixed cut of the power spectrum, so you know that you won't form structures below some scale, which also means below some time, and then you do the resolution test with this model. Otherwise, with pure CDM models, you will never get a real convergent test, because there's no limiting scale for structure formation. So I guess the point is that you need resolution to resolve disks and make disks as realistic as the ones that we see in the sky, and then you need instead feedback to get other things right, like the age of the disk, the number of satellites, and eventually also the ratio between the mass of the sphere and the mass of the disk. And I think it'll stop for now. So actually, there's a debate going on about that, because it might be that that's true for the star formation itself, but there are several other issues for which it is not clear at all that this entropy conserving formulation is better than other formulations. For example, there are people who are doing tests with gasoline gadgets and I think a third code. I think it's Finkter, right? And they actually find, and we don't know who's right yet, that, for example, the dissolution of satellites, I'm talking about satellites in a bigger system, so the dissolution of the gas components of the satellites is due to, you know, heating effects, is much more pronounced when you have an entropy conserving formulation than in the other two cases. But, you know, we don't know what's the closest, other two cases, I mean arithmetic or geometric formulation of the energy conservation. But we don't know which is actually closest to the reality. So I think the only way to set up a reasonable comparison is to compare different SPH codes with also other types of codes, like AMR, for example, or codes where really the entire way in which the heating and cooling and the energy evolution is done is different. And then, you know, do it in different situations, because there's never a correct answer from just looking at one situation. So I don't know now what's closer to reality.
Okay. The one question I had, I thought one way to get rid of the gas pile up in the center would be the star formation rate would be much higher when you have such a high surface density. But you seem to be saying that's not
the solution? I'm just curious.
Well, okay, so...
You've got 1,000 solar masses per square parsec.
Yeah, of course. So when you in most simulations that I showed you, of course, I didn't have star formation. The last ones, you mean? The one.
The last did.
You no. They didn't have star formation. Okay. Yeah. You're talking about the ones of M33, I guess. The profiles there. So if you add star formation to those simulations, you can. It goes down by maybe a factor of 5 the problem, because the stars, once they form, they can dynamically eat without radiating their energy. That's the main difference between, fluid and stars. But I don't think it's enough. And also, it's the scale. As I said, this dense nucleus that you see in M33 in the stars, it's on a smaller scale than the one that we get in the simulation. So I don't have an answer for that yet.
Lucho, when you say the satellite problem is solved by the process, it will be supernova due to photoionization.
So actually, this is something that we are trying to quantify at the moment, because we've run like 12 different simulations in which we have a combination of different feedback recipes. I mean, that recipe that I described includes 3 parameters at least. And so we ran simulations with changing each of these parameters, like the supernovae energy, the wind efficiency, the entrainment factor, or the timescale for turbulence, and or without, with or without UV eating. So now we will have, all the combinations with UV eating, without UV eating, different supernovae feedback strength, and we can answer eventually your question. At the moment, I don't know which is doing most of it. It clearly is both UV and supernovae. But there's no self-shielding in the head. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it's true. I mean, this is not included at the moment. So that it will certainly give you a lower limit to the effect that you can have.
So have you looked at the granularity of the stellar populations for the nuclear cases? Like, you see streams and stuff? Like, is it all... do a similar analysis as the
granularity? You mean in what? In the satellite?
Like, you have
there's a lot of
between the feedback case and the no feedback case should be significant.
Yeah.
Calculated.
Yeah.
How many
streams
you expect?
This is what, as I said, I mean, this last thing that I showed you is work in progress. So, this is part of the things that we need to do. And these two things is the amount of streams that you expect, and also the amount of mass in the stellar halo.
Sure.
They should differ by a lot. In the simulation without feedback, you get a stellar halo, which is, I think, is a factor of 3 or 4 more massive than the observational constraints that we have for the Milky Way. So it has to go down by a significant factor. Yeah.
Okay.